This recording is brought to you from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit our site at sevillepodcast.com for hours of lectures, radio shows, and more. Professor Kenneth Elzinga is a recipient of the Thomas Jefferson Award, the highest honor the University of Virginia accords its faculty. On Friday, September 18, 2009, Professor Elzinga spoke to the Society on the topic, Some Unconventional Principles of Leadership.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good evening, everyone. It's both a pleasure and an honor to be speaking in these halls. Economists look at life through the lens of probabilities. We rarely believe that anything is certain. When I was a boy, my Uncle Walter told me that the only thing in life that was certain was that you could not strike a match on a wet bar of soap. And I've never met anyone who's proven my Uncle Walter to be wrong about this. One other thing that's fairly certain is that most members of this distinguished group, the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society, will be leaders. And this does not mean you're all cut from the same cloth or that you'll all lead in the same fashion. From my observation over the years, the members of this society are very dissimilar, except in two regards. You all seem to have lots of intellectual energy and lots of intellectual horsepower. I've been asked to speak about leadership at the invitation of the society. And in the interest of full disclosure, let me stipulate that I do not teach a class on leadership, nor does my resume contain any books or articles about leadership. You could legitimately wonder, what credentials do I have to give a talk on leadership that takes you from your highest valued alternative opportunity foregone this evening? My credentials are these. Throughout my 40-plus years at the university, I've been part of a large, complex organization called Mr. Jefferson's University. I've observed several patterns of leadership from this vantage point. In addition, because of my research specialty in antitrust economics, I've consulted for corporations as different as Microsoft and Monsanto, Miller Brewing and Nestle, giant retailers like Walmart and AutoZone, and small ones like Brighton Collectibles. I've been a consultant to startup airlines like Spirit and established airlines like Continental. And I've served on the boards of nonprofit and for-profit organizations. And in each instance, what I've tried to do is observe, how are these organizations led? What do the leaders do, and what do they not do? And in addition, as a follower of Jesus, I've tried to think about how Jesus led his disciples. There are, as I'm sure you're aware, various theories or schools of thought about leadership. Machiavelli's is the most famous. It emphasizes strategy and deception and justifies most any means necessary to achieve a desired end. And I've observed leaders who are Machiavellian. There are schools of thought on leadership that involve changing your personality in order to lead. The whole Dale Carnegie movement is based on the idea that you can be taught to win friends and influence people. And having won them under this theory, you can then influence or lead them. And I suspect, even as young as most of you are, you've observed leaders who tell their subordinates what they want to hear and who are able to adapt their personalities so as to be liked in order to accomplish their objective. There are schools of leadership that are essentially hierarchical. This is the central feature of leadership in the military. There are even leadership theories that are biological in their foundation. These theories contend that a Bill Gates or a Helen Keller, they're born. There really is no accounting for their leadership. It can't be taught somewhere. Nobody else could replicate it or learn how they lead. There also are characteristics of leadership that only a novelist can describe and understand. Now I'll be candid with you here. After Marshall Jevons, my favorite fiction writer is Joseph Conrad. And who can forget Mr. Kurtz, the inscrutable leader of the station in Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness? Let me read something to you about Mr. Kurtz. He was obeyed, yet he inspired neither love, nor fear, nor even respect. He inspired uneasiness. That was it, uneasiness. Not a definite mistrust, just uneasiness, nothing more. You have no idea how effective such a faculty can be. He had no genius for organizing, for initiative, or for order even. He originated nothing. He could keep the routine going, that's all. But he was great. He was great by this little thing that was impossible to tell what could control such a man. He never gave that secret away. Scott Adams, the cartoonist for Dilbert, captures this kind of leadership in the contemporary corporate world. What economists clinically call the principal agent problem, Adams depicts in a visual fashion that makes his readers laugh and wince at the same time. In most theories of leadership, leaders are assumed to be people with large budgets, lots of subordinates, and great power. Leaders say jump and people jump. They say boo and people are afraid. And in conventional wisdom, leaders are people who head large corporations, who run hospitals and universities. They direct large bureaucracies. They're high in military command. They're the head coaches of top-tier athletic teams. All these people lead. But this evening, I'm going to work with a broader definition of leadership. Leadership is being in a position of influencing other people. If you influence people, and these people cannot avoid your influence, by my definition, for purposes of this evening, you're a leader. So, the Secretary of Health and Human Services or the Secretary of the Department of Defense is a leader, potentially influencing thousands of people. But by this metric, an RA at the university also is a leader. Influencing, from my observation, sometimes profoundly, a handful of people in a McCormick Road dorm. Someone who participates in a tutoring program at Madison House or the Abundant Life Center leads, again, sometimes profoundly. Mothers and fathers lead. Someone who teaches a class of school children leads. And it's in this context that there are three unconventional principles of leadership that I want to describe. And from my experience at UVA, my experience in consulting, and my experience in serving on boards, these represent the type of leadership that I admire. And let me run through each of them by name, and then I'll talk about each. The first is leadership by personal example. The second is going to seem odd to some of you in a talk on leadership. It's the principle of the inadequate leader. And the third is the principle of servant leadership. And this last one is a radical principle of leadership. So let me begin with leadership by example. Many people who lead by example we never hear about because only those immediately around them fully witness their example. And if I had to pick a stellar illustration of such a person who led not because of her charisma and not because of the size of her organization, but simply because of her example, it would be Mother Teresa. She didn't ask others to do anything that she herself was unwilling to do. And instead, she set the tone for her organization by her own personal behavior. Max Dupree, the former CEO of Herman Miller, also led by example. Herman Miller, if you don't know, is a corporation that is consistently voted as one of the top places to work in the United States. People in top management at Herman Miller uniformly observed that Max Dupree treated employees on the shop floor, on the production line, with the same sense of honor and respect as he did his top management team. And many of the top managers at Herman Miller, following their CEO's example, came to lead by this same principle of leadership. Now, leading by example can move in a lot of different directions. Bill Gates, by his example, led many young, bright Microsoft employees to believe that curtness and coarse language and putting people down went along with leadership. What's key to understanding this principle of leadership is that the leader is always on, always on. The leader does not only lead when up front before an audience, but the leader is influencing subordinates by how he or she goes about activities and endeavors that are just every day. phone demeanor, wording of emails, and a host of daily activities and mannerisms can influence subordinates, for better or for worse, even more than the leader's persona on public occasions. Leadership by example is a 24/7 theory of leadership. Now let's move to leadership principle number two. To my mind, the second most famous leader in all of history would be Moses. Some of my Jewish colleagues would rank Moses as the most famous leader ever. The biblical account of Moses leading the Israelites out of the land of Egypt, the so-called Exodus story, becomes a theme that runs through the literature of the Western world and profoundly influences the American civil rights movement. One feature that makes the story of Moses remarkable, to me at least, is that when God called Moses to be a leader, Moses was not a member of a distinguished debating society such as this one. He was not at the Darden School getting an MBA or a PhD. He was not a White House fellow being groomed for political leadership. He was not even the head of something called Amalgamated Olive and Date Processors, Inc. He was engaged in one of the lowliest of pursuits. Moses was a shepherd. He was in the desert tending not even his own flocks, the flocks of his father-in-law. And when called to lead the people of Israel, Moses said, in effect, "Wait a minute, Lord, not me. You got the wrong person. I'm not capable, I'm not qualified, and furthermore, I don't want the job." Moses was convinced he was inadequate. He told God so. He asked one of the most famous questions in the Bible. Who am I? Who am I that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? God had to teach Moses it really didn't matter who he, Moses, was, so long as God was going to be there. And if you ever happen to read the accounts of other leaders in the Old Testament of the Bible, you find this very same principle being repeated. Gideon and Jeremiah both balked when being called to lead. Both were told that God would offset their inadequacies. Recognizing their inadequacy, now hear me on this, recognizing their inadequacy is what taught them dependence on God so they could lead. Now let me turn from biblical times to the present. Moses and Gideon and Jeremiah were not the only leaders to feel inadequate. This is not a phenomenon confined to biblical times. Many leaders today sense their own deep inadequacy. They may look confident, they may have the physical trappings of confidence and authority. The impression they may convey is one of certainty and control. And for many leaders, this is a myth. Allow me to be personal here, if I may. In the fall semester, as some of you know, I am the leader of a large principles of economics class of over 1,000 students and 20 teaching assistants. This is not just a teaching assignment, it's an organizational problem. And I believe myself to be inadequate for this. I sometimes feel sick to my stomach before entering the classroom because I sense that I know so little about the subject and it's so hard to teach and there's so many students and TAs dependent on what I do. And I'm not the only leader to feel inadequate. Recently, I was an economic consultant to a Fortune 500 firm where I had the opportunity to get to know the number two person in the firm. Many expect him to be the CEO someday. He's very smart in one of the most sophisticated areas of market dynamics. But when he gets up to talk, to give a speech, he is so uncertain of himself that his lecture notes remind him when to swallow. He would not likely be a candidate for the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society. Lots of people feel inadequate for the task set before them. Maybe some of you have felt this way. And if you have, then you can join this club where many leaders are members. The biblical solution to the principle of inadequacy that Moses and Gideon and Jeremiah shared is that beneath their inadequacy, God is sufficient. Now again, I'm going to be very candid here. For those of you who do not believe in a personal God who can supply strength and wisdom, the inadequate leader needs a supportive staff to offset the inadequacies. Inadequate leaders who mask their shortcomings become leaders who exemplify the so-called Peter principle. Leaders who were great at their prior position and get promoted to a level of incompetency. And from this position of leadership, they wreak organizational havoc. Many of you who are undergraduates, within 10 years of your work experience, if not already, will at least witness, if not suffer, at the hands of leaders who mask and do not acknowledge their inadequacies. Now, if you would now, join me in thinking of the leader as a servant. This is leadership principle number 3. First off, joining the two words, servant and leader, in some theories of leadership would be an oxymoron. The servant, well, the servant's the follower, the subordinate, the lowest person in the pecking order. The servant is just the opposite of the leader, but not in the biblical sense. Professors in the Department of Religious Studies at UVA who contend that the most prominent image or picture of the Christian faith, they would probably say, well, that would be the crucifix. For me, as a teacher, it's the image or the picture of Jesus washing the feet of his disciples. I keep such a picture on my office wall. The scene, to me at least, illustrates the upside-down and paradoxical principle of leadership that the one who leads should be willing to serve. Or to put it a little differently, if you want to be first, you line up last. What this suggests is that if I want to lead a class of students, I should be willing to serve them. And for me, it goes even beyond that. From a biblical perspective, my authority as a teacher is linked to my willingness to serve my students. You may have heard it said that some people who spent their 20s in the pursuit of sex, finding no ultimate satisfaction there, spent their 30s in the pursuit of money. And finding no ultimate satisfaction there, they spent the rest of their lives in the pursuit of power. And ultimately, they end up wanting to be leaders because of the power that it gives them over others. And in doing so, such people exhibit the exact opposite of the servant model of leadership, and the influence they have upon those below them is dreadful, just dreadful. Because of them, the world comes to see power as the taproot of leadership rather than servanthood. The servant leader model says, if you want to be first, you must be willing to line up last. You must be willing to say, I influence others in this organization. They cannot avoid my influence. I'm also willing to wash their feet, to be concerned about their interests as well as my own. Now, please hear me on this. From this particular perspective, leadership is not a matter of inflicting pain. It's a matter of bearing pain for the sake of others. Now, I'm nearing the conclusion of my remarks. My college speech teacher, taking a speech class back when I was the age of many of you, told me that it was very important to let my audience know when I was drawing to a close. She said it would revive hope among those who were still awake. So that's the signal. I'm drawing near to a close here. Once upon a time, the people of Israel said they wanted to have a king, like the neighboring countries had. So God told the people of Israel what kind of a king they should have. God said, don't get a king who's enamored with weapons, who wants lots of silver and gold, and who desires many wives. Now, a king of the nearby countries at the time, maybe the king of the Amalekites or the Moabites or the Midianites, might have thought, I sure wouldn't want to be a king of Israel. I mean, why be a king if you can't have a harem and lots of silver and gold and military might? I've taught many students at UVA who would think this way. After all, why be a leader if you're supposed to set a good example instead of ordering people around? Why be a leader if you're inadequate to the task? Why be a leader if it doesn't lead to sexual conquests? Why be a leader if you can't lord it over others and are instead supposed to be a servant leader? These are very good questions. Why indeed? The biblical answer for those who would go there is because God doesn't want leaders who are hung up on possessions, are hung up on sex, or hung up on power. According to the Bible, even the king of Israel was not to consider himself better than others. Leadership like this may seem odd to us. And that may be because there's so little leadership like this. I can recall being in a meeting of a board of trustees on which I serve, and we were addressing a very serious organizational problem. Not do or die, but it was important and serious. And we were pressing forward to a solution that would minimize the risk to us and the organization, and it seemed the strategic thing to do. I was all for it. It would show us to be a tough-minded, realistic board of leaders. And then a member of the board, who was a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, made a proposal that was almost 180 degrees different from where the rest of us were heading. This is a man who has a tendency to do this. And as I considered his seemingly off-the-wall solution, I thought to myself, this is a leader who serves. This is a leader who's willing to bear pain and not just inflict it on others. Let me close this way. Sometimes I visit former students of mine on their professional turf in another city. And you know what I might say to you if someday you're showing me around your new office and your professional digs and you tell me about the promotions of leadership you've been given? I might ask you, do you know the name of the person who cleans your office and takes out the trash? I might ask you, if that person were in trouble or family member of theirs were in trouble and they didn't have the skills or the resources to figure out how the system could work to help them, would they think of you as someone they could come to for understanding and assistance? Would you help them? The answer is they probably would not come to you if you don't even know their name. So what does a university culture have to be like to produce servant leaders? How does a university culture tell students, as this one does, over and again, that they are the best and the brightest, and then allow them to be leaders like Moses, who know they're inadequate for the task of leadership? And I don't raise these questions only for others at Mr. Jefferson's university and elsewhere. These are questions I ask myself. There are two reasons to draw this talk to a close. One is I want the opportunity to hear your questions and reactions. The second is because I'm an economist. Economic theory is the one subject at the university, out of all the disciplines taught here, that has a theory to explain why there is too much talk in the world. It's because the supply exceeds the demand. So I will stop the supply right now, and I look forward to entertaining any questions or comments you might have. Well, one thing I know from prior experience with this group is that shyness is not in large supply here. So, yes? Sure. The question is, what advice do I have for a person who's in somewhat the same situation I'm in when I go and teach Econ 201? A sense of, wow, this is an awesome responsibility, whether it's teaching a big class or taking a test that's important on your professional or educational agenda. I think, first of all, is to get rid of the fallacy that infects much of the culture of this university, that you can't fail because you've been told that you're too good. You're just too successful or you wouldn't be a student here. And lots of students that I meet around here have been told so often by their parents, but often by just the university culture, that you're the best and the brightest, and therefore, if you don't perform up to that level, something's wrong. It's cognitive dissonance. So I think there needs to be a realistic recognition that most of us aren't geniuses. I've taught 35,000 students here at the university plus. There are two that I think were geniuses. That's it. So, and they're not here tonight, I'm sorry to say. At least I don't see them out there. That's not to say that there aren't some very talented people here, but most people aren't geniuses. They are the statistical outliers. And it's to recognize that most of us fall more towards the middle of the bell curve. Now, from my theological perspective, as I suggested in my talk, it's comforting to know that I'm in good company, that Moses and Gideon and others that that God was able to use in some fruitful way also believed themselves to be inadequate. And so then you ask, well, what are the other sources of strength? For me, my faith is one source of strength. It also helps to be prepared. You know, if you're going to take a test, I remember there's a famous story, I don't know if it's true or not, but I think it's a good story about Martin Luther during the height of the Reformation when he was being asked to speak at cathedral after cathedral. And he was so busy that he just thought, I just don't have time to prepare. I'm going to get up and give this sermon and just trust God to speak to me. And he got up, it might have been in Köln, I forget, some big cathedral, and he climbed up to the top of this thing, and God did speak to him. God said, Martin Luther, you're not prepared. And so there is a sense in which it helps to be prepared, but to have realistic expectations about it and to be content with whatever measure of gifts and talents that you have. Boy, that's a great question. I'll repeat it. When do I think was Jesus' strongest moment of leadership, and when was his weakest moment? For me, speaking in terms of the, as a Christian, believing in the redemptive properties of Jesus on the cross, that Jesus' strongest moment of leadership was when he showed himself to be such a servant that he would sacrifice himself for the sake of people like me, sinners like me, by his death on the cross. And then his willingness to be on the cross to say to those who persecuted and were killing him, killing his human body, to forgive them. That was his strongest moment of leadership. The weakest one is a tough one. I mean, that's even a tough one as a matter of theology, because from my perspective, this is the Son of God who lived a sinless life. But if I had to say, where did Jesus seem most vulnerable? It was when he was out in the desert being tempted by Satan. And while he survived that test, it seemed to me that his human's form was the most vulnerable then. Now, I have some good friends that I respect who might say that his most vulnerable time was when, prior to his crucifixion, when he thought he was abandoned. He just thought, Father, where are you? You know, take this cup from me, the famous line of, take this cup from me. That would be another moment, whether you call it weakness or vulnerability, but where he needed deep reservoirs of strength from his divinity to be able to carry through the mission that he had set for himself. Great question. Great question. Wow. Yes. Yeah. Is there some characteristic of leadership that I think goes across all leaders? I don't think so. As I said, what I've read on leadership, so much of the literature on leadership that you might study formally involves strategic maneuvering. And there's a role for that in leadership, maybe a necessary role in a fallen world. It's not a form of leadership that I admire from having watched leaders. It may be that leadership by intimidation, what I observed at Microsoft, this kind of coarse treatment of subordinates, and people looking to that and thinking, well, I guess that's the way you get ahead, is whether you can handle the rough and tumble of that environment. I found it repugnant myself. I really did. It was not a form of leadership that I admired. It had no sense of inadequacy to it. It had no sense of real servant leadership. So two of the characteristics that I admire about leadership were largely absent, notwithstanding the enormous success of Microsoft and in some ways the very important contributions the company has made to technological progress. It didn't have the culture of leadership that I would admire. Yes. Yeah. The question is, first of all, the quote from Kissinger, the second part of your quote is from Lord Acton. Kissinger may have taken that, but the notion that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely is from Acton. But Kissinger was famous for his remark because he was a ladies' man and said the reason people were attracted to him was not his good looks or his accent, but the power that he had. He understood the magnetic attraction that he had because he was such a powerful person. And the latter part of your question is a very interesting one, and that is, does this corruption exist in all leaders? In one sense, the answer to that is yes, or at least from my perspective, because of the fall, that we are all fallen creatures. We're created in God's image, but we're deeply affected by the fall. And we are all prone, when we have positions of power, to want to abuse it. That is why, and I'll speak very candidly here again, that is why the image of Jesus washing the feet of his disciples is so, I won't use the word comforting, it's not. It's so sobering. It causes me to think, you know, Ken, you profess to be a follower of Jesus. What would it mean to wash the feet of your students? And for those of you who aren't really up on the New Testament, Jesus was frequently called rabbi by his followers. He wasn't called Messiah, typically, or Son of God. He was called rabbi, which is a word for professor or teacher. So here's a person who is willing to wash the feet of his disciples, or in my context, his students. And so for me, knowing the corruption that is a part of my nature from the fall, if I'm going to lead in a biblical model, in a way that I admire, the so-called servant leadership, what does it mean for me to be willing to wash the feet of my students? Does it mean literally? I don't think so, although I've thought about that. I really have. Strange as it may sound to you, I have wondered what it would mean if I went over to Newcomb Hall with a bucket and a towel and said, I'm here to wash the feet of 201 students. The only reason I wouldn't do that, there's maybe a couple reasons, but one of them is I'm afraid it would be misinterpreted as a sort of religious show of piety, and I wouldn't want that. The main reason to do it is not because my students need to have their feet washed, is this would be another process of breaking my pride, of saying, Ken, you know, you're not who you think you are, or who you want to be, or who you profess to be. You really are a person desperately in need of God's salvation, and you're desperately in need of a community of people who will care for you. And those are desperate needs I have. And washing the feet, that may be why Jesus commended that, is not so much the disciples needed to have their feet clean, but people who did that would learn something about humility. And I continually need to learn that. As old as I am, I continually need to learn lessons of humility. You know, speaking of this group, and Carolyn and saying, oh, he did this, and he got this award, and the highest award the universe has got. I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, that's who I am. But that's just part of who I am. I'm a person with desperate needs as well. Yeah, thanks. Two in the back. Seated first. Ladies first. Sure. Question was, how do I reconcile my beliefs, my views of leadership into a corporate culture that really does not reflect that? I'm going to have to take about 4 or 5 minutes to answer your question, and I won't apologize for it, but I just want to do it accurately and as carefully as I can, and probably in a way that will be helpful to people. First of all, when you consult for a company, it doesn't mean that you approve of or applaud everything they do. That's a misconception with a lot of Virginia undergraduates. They heard that I consulted for Microsoft, and they think, well, he must approve of everything they do. Frequently, consultants are brought in because they may bring a different perspective that the interior management believes might be lacking. Now, Microsoft did not bring me in to talk about corporate culture and to try and make Bill Gates' language clean up or something like that. I would have welcomed that task, but that was not why I was brought in. I was brought in to try and solve some very pressing and serious antitrust problems that they had and try to advise them as to what sort of pricing strategies and so on they might adopt to get out of a major antitrust issue that they had. Now, how you conduct yourself in that setting. In the case of Microsoft, for example, I was asked to take some positions in a courtroom that I didn't agree with, and I quit. I just quit. I said, I can't do that, and if you expect me to do that, you are talking to the wrong person. Maybe some people who will do that sort of thing, but if you heard that I would do that, you were misinformed, and I quit. And that just went around the corporation. I forgot one part of it. I said to the person, I said, you have to understand that there's not one thing Microsoft has that I want. Because he had said to me when I quit, he said, well, you can't quit. He said, you're immersed in this project. And I said, you have to understand, there's not one thing Microsoft has that I want. And that's true. I mean, I I can't think of anything that, I mean, the software, I already had the software. I mean, what, you know, what do they have? Now, lest I sound really brave in saying that, the real test is whether I would have said that if I were on the Microsoft payroll. So I want to be real clear. It is in some sense a cheap shot to be a person of real integrity if you're consulting, because I've got a tenured job at the university, I make a good income here, I really can walk away. I admire much more people who are employees of an organization, who are full-time employees, that this is 100% of their income, who go out the door over an issue of integrity. I have never been tested in that area. I'm not sure whether I would pass that test or not. I would hope I would, but it's not that hard to pass it when you're a consultant. And then, oddly enough, the people rendezvoused and brought me back and said, well, let's try again. Let's try this again. We understand now sort of what the parameters are in the workplace with you. Another area, this did not happen with Microsoft, although it could have because the language is so coarse at that firm. I have a... Because I'm a follower of Jesus, just the name Jesus and Jesus Christ is an elevated or holy name for me. It's a name that is I would revere. But for a lot of people, it's a curse word. And I was in a setting not long ago where a person was, in biblical term, just taking the Lord's name in vain. Jesus Christ this, God damn this, and so on. And he was particularly upset with subordinates. This was at a law firm. And I listened to this for a while, and it was very troubling to me, very troubling. And again, it's not because I'm pompous or pure, but this was Jesus' name. It was being taken in vain, and I struggled for a while as to what to do. And finally, I said to the person, his first name is Don, I said, Don, when you take Jesus' name in vain like that, for me, would be as if I said to you, your mother's a prostitute. I said, has that sort of emotional impact upon me? If I said that to you, it would just stop what you were thinking about. The whole project that we're working on, you would just, my mother's a prostitute? I said, well, that's what it does to me. And he very quickly backpedaled and apologized. I said, oh, Ken, I'm sorry. It just comes out. I don't even know I say it. I'm sorry I didn't mean to offend you, blah, 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 blah. After the meeting was over, three associates in that law firm came to me and said, thank you for calling him out on his language. We didn't dare do that, but we find it very troubling as well. Now, the strange thing is that when this guy was backpedaling and apologizing and saying, oh, I didn't know I was saying this, you know, it just comes out and I can't help it, he stopped. People have told me that Don no longer swears. Now, I consider that like a miracle. That's like divine intervention. Divine intervention came in. That would be another example of where, in some small way, I will try to, whatever you want to call it, mellow or make more congenial a culture of an organization. A culture of an organization. Yes? Yeah. Probably everybody was able to hear the question because it came from the back, but it's the idea that whether you look in biblical times or in modern times or with Mother Teresa, there's a great deal of suffering in an organization. How much should a leader ask subordinates to suffer? Not more than the leader is willing to suffer would be my glib answer. Now, how that gets worked out in a lot of situations, I'm not sure. But as I mentioned in my talk, one of the, I think, paradoxical aspects of the leadership model that I'm commending is that leadership is not the ability to inflict pain on somebody else. It's not, good leadership is not seeing some young kid make a mistake and just chewing him out, sort of Microsoft style, and humiliating him. And the idea is out of that humiliation will come harder work or a winnowing of, a Darwinian winnowing of the organization. The leader who is not just inflicting pain, but rather is bearing pain, is the type of leader that I've come to admire. That was totally new to me. I was a kid that grew up in a non-commercial, non-academic, non-organizational setting, and it was new to me to begin to see leaders who did not relish inflicting pain on others, but actually soberly as an aspect of leadership would bear the pain of others. And now, you know, how that works out if you're the CEO of a company and you've got to lay off a group of people in a plant, or you're going to close a plant because the plant is no longer remunerative to shareholders, I don't think that biblical principle suggests that the CEO also loses his or her job. Maybe it does, but I don't think so. But I think there are ways in which that closing of a plant can be done in a way that is cold and callous, and in a way that exhibits some sort of tenderness and empathy. And the leadership style that I admire would be the latter, because it somehow is bearing pain itself. And as I say, you know, if you take that very far within a lot of UVA culture, you think, well, why would you want to be a leader? And I think leadership would be healthier if more people ask that question. Because they say, well, maybe I don't want to be a leader if that's what leadership involves. Yes, Paul? Yeah. The second part of Paul's question is there some way to quantify or measure the variables of the sort of leadership that I've been discussing and in some sense applauding here? I'm not enough of a student of organizational behavior to know the kind of metrics that might lead to the quantification of that. So Max Dupree, the CEO of Herman Miller, how you measure that at the culture of Herman Miller, somehow that gets measured in everybody always uniformly saying this is one of the best corporations in the world to work for. I don't have the expertise. I'm an economist. I think most everything can be measured, or there can be some signal that would measure it. I would like to believe there's ways of measuring that within organizations. Some ways of measuring the extent of principal-agent problems, how they're solved, what the culture of an organization is like. You certainly, as a consultant, I know that when I go into Continental Airlines, that it is a very different organization than Spirit Airlines, that Nestle is very different from Miller Brewing Company, even though the black box model that I teach in Econ 201 is this firm that takes in inputs and puts out outputs under the rubric of profit maximization. The cultures within firms differ radically. Microsoft is very different from Brighton Collectibles. How you measure that, I'd like to believe people, you know, in B schools can do that. The difference between power and influence, sure, I think there is a difference. Just take my example of the RA in a McCormick Road dorm. I've seen RAs that have, I don't want to push the button too hard and make it literal, but they've been lifesavers for first-year students. First-year students who are really troubled, and they may not come to me. They may not go to their dean. They're too embarrassed to go to their parents, or maybe their parents aren't really there for them. And an RA comes along, and in some sense, the RA is not a person of power at the university, but they have very profound and sometimes remarkably beneficial influence. There are people who seem to be in a position of power, presidents of the United States at times, that don't seem to be able to influence events in the ways that they would like to. They have all the trappings of power, at least, all the symbols of power, the 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue address, the limousines, the Secret Service, and they want a particular program, and they can't, and I'm not talking about some big program like healthcare reform. They're trying to get the Department of Justice to behave in a certain way at the Antitrust Division. They can't seem to make it happen because bureaucrats and civil servants are so entrenched there that they figure, I'll wait this guy out. You know, in 3 years, this person's gone. So I think there are differences between power and influence. The R squared between the two might be fairly high, but there can be differences between the two. Yes. Yeah. Well, the examples that you mentioned, I think, set a horrible example, just a horrible example. The type of language, the setting, all of it is just wrong, it seems to me. And, you know, I'll just, and the influence, it's hard to say. I don't know enough about the extent to which people are influenced by the popular culture, because I am almost, it came up at dinner tonight with some of you, I'm almost immunized from popular culture. I'm the only person in this room who has never seen an episode of Seinfeld, or Friends, or Cheers, or goes all the way back to Little House on the Prairie. I just don't know these things. People talk about them. I know they're out there. I know it's important. But I don't know. I just don't know that. So when a movie figure, a singer, or something like this says something that strikes me as being uncivil or wrong or horrible language or the wrong setting, for all I know, many, many people who live and breathe this culture are influenced by it. This is their role model. Where I see it is in a corporate setting as a consultant. So I go to Microsoft and I see the way Bill Gates can influence the culture of a company just by his language. If Gates did not have such a coarse language, there is no doubt that the many young people who go there, extremely talented and bright and eager to succeed and hardworking, very hardworking, that if he had different language, they would have different language. And if he has coarse language, they have coarse language. Not everybody, I don't want to draw that. Everybody says, oh, they're all in lockstep. But it affects the influence. Just as a probationary comes in here and sees a certain behavior of the leaders, and they will say, well, that, I guess, is how you behave at the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society. For good or for ill, that's how you behave. And that happens in corporations. It happens in universities. Those are the two worlds, really the only two worlds I know best. Only two worlds I kind of populate. So the influence of singers and so on, I don't know. I go through the grocery aisles and I see People magazine and I see all this stuff about these people. And they're kind of names to me now, but I just know them from the title of the magazine kind of thing. Or sometimes they're on my Yahoo homepage. That's how I learned of the, is it Kanye West? Kenny West? Kanye West? So I'm not even sure how to pronounce these names. I learned the other day that there's a singer coming named Bono, and I think for all I knew it was Bono. It's Bono, I guess. See, I mean, I really am out of it. You have to understand that. Yes. Well, the principles of Christian leadership, to my mind, go to a very kind of an old-fashioned notion. I'm not even sure you'd encounter this in the B-school world, Paul, but it's a notion of calling. Or vocation, or the notion of vocare, to call. And it's a very, has a long tradition in Christian principles that people are called to work. And one of the great principles of the Reformation was that this calling did not just mean to a clerical role, to be a priest or a rabbi. It was a calling to all kinds of work. It could be a calling to milk cows, because that was the way God was going to provide that people got milk, was calling people to be dairymen and to milk cows. And it's a real blessing. It's one I would wish for all of you who are in school, that someday you would have, kind of regardless of your religious convictions, that you would have a sense of calling, that what you're doing is what you were called to do. Now, if you're a believer in a personal God, then ideally that would be the icing on the cake, would be to believe that God called you to this position. But if you're not supernaturally disposed in terms of your philosophy, that you're basically of a secular mindset, I would still wish for you the blessing that in your work you would have a sense that you were called to this, that by whatever process, this is what you were gifted to do, this is what you were talented to do. And that is so liberating, because it means that when you are offered other positions, people come to headhunters or whatever, and they say, wouldn't you like to work for this company? Wouldn't you like to be the president of this university? For me, I have the great liberty of saying, no, thank you. That's not my calling. Now, it's not to say God, again, I'm speaking from a Christian perspective here, God couldn't change your calling. That you're a professor and you're called to be a dean or a president. That has not been my circumstance. So I have offers to do these things, and for me it's just liberating. It's not constricting. I'm not, oh, should I do this, should I not do this? Because I have a sense of calling to teach at the University of Virginia. So that's what I would wish for all of you, is that, you know, as you think about jobs, don't just think about, well, what pays the most or what has the most prestige. Those are things to consider. It's human nature to think of those things, and I'd be denying your human nature if I said don't think of them. But in the midst of all that, ask yourself the question, what do I seem to be gifted at doing? What do I seem to be, to use the theological term, what do I seem to be called to? And It's so refreshing for me to meet a UVA student who's an econ major and who's really great at econ and math and has all the credentials for a phenomenally successful career on Wall Street. And they'll say, you know, Mr. Elzinga, what I think I'd like to do is teach high school math. And what they're really saying is not just, I think I'd like to do that. I put that through the lens that's a calling for them. And I will tell you that if this guy, and I've seen this, if this guy or gal goes up to New York and does investment banking, they will not be fulfilled in that. They may be successful. They may make tons of money and have a corner office, but somewhere in their heart is a calling that's unfulfilled, and that was to be in a high school somewhere teaching math to kids, because that's what God had gifted them, if not called them to do. So when you're thinking about careers, boy, you know, I mean, some of you will get phenomenal offers. They're not phenomenal if they sit outside your calling. Thank you very much.